Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today we are going to talk about location as it comes to figuring out how you should pay back your student loans and why does it matter so very much. I hope that you're having a wonderful holiday season with you and your family. I hope that you're staying safe, and I hope that you are making the best out of a really, really difficult situation this year. I know that I wish we could all get together with loved ones, and just it's a kind of a giant mess, this whole COVID stuff. So let's try to distract you with a little bit of ways that you could save money on your student loans and a little bit of ways you can just figure out what you want out of life more generally. So this episode will be hopefully wide-reaching, expanding not just to your student loan strategy, but many more things than that. First, I've got a question from a listener, and remember that you can ask questions like this at studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. This is a really, really great question, and it seems like it could be a giant loophole at first glance. So let's listen to this question from Anonymous.
Hey, Travis. My question relates to being on 1099 income. A strategy that's often used is you will have an LLC and elect to file as an S-Corp, and then you can split your income into salary and distributions and set a reasonable salary. So for instance, say you're earning $300,000 and you set your reasonable income as $200,000, then you wouldn't pay Medicare taxes on that $100,000 as a tactic often used to reduce your tax burden. I was wondering if you could use the same tactic for paying less on income-driven repayment if you were then to go for the 20 or 25-year taxable repayment. So then instead of using your tax return, could you use that business structure where you're paying yourself a W-2 salary with a pay stub? Could you show that pay stub as your income to certify your income instead of your tax return? Thanks.
Okay, what a great question. What this listener is asking is when you work as a 1099 contractor, or if you have your own business, really this could apply to anyone who is not a W-2 wage earner. A lot of people, what they will do is ask for their CPA to set up something called an S-corporation, and it's usually an S-corporation LLC. So why does that matter? Well, if you make up to about $130,000 or so, you have to pay the Social Security taxes and Medicare taxes on that income. So that's about 12% for Social Security and about 3%, I think, for Medicare. That's about a 15% self-employment tax. It's really, really high. If you're working for someone, your employer pays half of that. So they pay about 7.5% or so. And I'm using approximate numbers here. So they pay half of it without you really even seeing, and then you get half of that deducted out of your paycheck. Now, when you're a 1099, you have to pay for the full freight on that. And so what a lot of CPAs will do is they'll say, well, wait a second. Say you're a 1099, I don't know, I'm just going to make something up. Say you're a 1099 psychologist. I'm using that example just because I think the numbers might make sense from what I'm about to say. So if you're a 1099 psychologist, and let's say that your CPA can say, well, actually, a reasonable salary for a psychologist, if you're going to pay someone, might be $60,000. And so you would take $60,000 as a wage and $40,000 as a profit distribution. The reason you would do that is because that would allow you to not have to pay Social Security or Medicare taxes on that $40,000 that you distribute to yourself as a dividend from your S corporation. Generally speaking, this costs maybe $1,000 or $2,000 to set up and manage a year with an accountant. And why would you do that? Well, if you save 15% on $40,000, that's $6,000. So that is kind of three times as much in savings as it costs to set this up. So most people with a 1099 source of income that's significant will save more than the tax preparation fees by setting up an S corporation so that they can pay themselves what's quote unquote deemed a reasonable wage and then take the rest as a distribution. So for higher income people, you might not be able to give yourself a wage that avoids the full Social Security tax because you might make more in your reasonable wage than the Social Security wage cap of like $130,000 something. But the Medicare tax has no cap. The Medicare tax is taxed on your wages basically to an unlimited amount. And so the S corporation is a way that you can save on that 3% Medicare tax by setting yourself a salary that's lower than what your actual total profit is for a business. So that's what our listener's question really pertains to. This listener is essentially asking, well, I found this awesome realization that I can pay myself a wage and then I take the rest as a dividend. So don't I only have to pay my student loan IDR plan based off of my wage and not the dividends from my S corporation? So isn't this a wonderful loophole where you could save so much money, pay so much less on your IDR payments, and you could get way more forgiveness and the student loan planner messing you up and not helping you out as much as we could by not telling you about this loophole? And like some things in student loans, it's true, and some things it's not true. And this is one of those examples where, unfortunately, this is not how it works. So you simply need to reference the income-driven repayment plan recertification form, okay? So I'm going to quote you from page 3, section 5. It says, you must document all taxable income that you and your spouse currently receive. Then it defines taxable income as including, for example, income from employment, unemployment, dividends, interest income, tips, and alimony. It says, do not provide documentation of untaxed income, such as supplemental security income, which is what Social Security disability is, child support, or federal or state public assistance, welfare cash payments, for example. So it's extremely clear that you have to include all sources of taxable income, and S corporation income is fully taxable income, even if it's not being distributed as wages. So unfortunately, no, you do have to pay on that full profit for your business. There's no loophole to not pay on that full profit. In fact, we've seen some examples of even the servicers telling borrowers to commit fraud by only reporting wages instead of reporting the full profit from your S corporation. That's just because a person making $15 an hour is not familiar with complicated IRS tax codes and different kinds of business filing strategies. So they're going to tell you something, and it doesn't matter if they told you that. If some, you know, CPA tells you to commit fraud and you do it, then it's still fraud, right? Even if the person told you to do it. And that's not a CPA telling you to do that, which they make mid to high five figures or even low six figures, right? Where somebody has to go get a lot of credentials and training and really at least know something. You're talking to a servicer rep, which nothing wrong with servicer reps out there, right? There's a lot of good ones, but the average qualifications and pay that that role has means that the average people that gravitate to and stay in that position tend to not have a ton of training and qualifications and credentials, and tend to not be necessarily the most competent people out there just because of the pay that the servicers offer. So that's a great example of a great idea, but that's not how it works. And I will say this, there was a bill in Congress that we were monitoring that would have allowed people to pay only as a percentage of their wages. And if that had happened, it would have drastically changed the game and made being your own boss extraordinarily beneficial for student loan borrowers, because S-Corp people could have paid their loans on that and their payments would have drastically decreased. So don't worry, we've got you covered. We're certainly monitoring these things. And that's a wonderful question. I hope we get more like that. Now let's change gears and talk about the premise of today's show, why your location matters when you're trying to figure out what your student loan strategy should be. Consider this case study that I recently came across from one of my consults. I had this couple that was looking at doing a private practice job in the Northeast, and they were going to be in that location, or they were going to be kind of in the middle part of the country, say in rural Minnesota, right? And so they were looking at those two separate jobs to decide which one that they should take. One thing that we know, pretty much ironclad, is that if you're in the Northeast as a private practice owner, you can make a lot of money. It's possible. You can really kill it and just crush things and just make gobs of money and be very financially successful. However, if you were making $200,000 a year as a dentist, for example, in the Northeast, that's really good. You are doing fine. You're probably above average for all practice owners in the Northeast, and specifically in big cities. Now, if you are in the middle to northern part of Minnesota and you're making $300,000, that is probably, my guess is that's probably below average for practice owners in that location. And so what does that mean for this person? In this particular case, if you go out to one of these out-of-the-way areas where you're going to make a lot more money, that would have made this person a lot more attractive candidate to do a student loan refinancing to pay back this person's debt. Whereas if they wanted to live in the Northeast and have that lifestyle where you have the big city, access to cultural amenities, that's just a little bit of a different lifestyle, that would have been a lot more beneficial to pursue a student loan forgiveness type of strategy. And so that's really quite fascinating, because a lot of people face decisions like this. Where do I live? What is that going to mean for my long-term financial future? Will I be able to buy a house? Will I be able to send my kids to a good school? Will I enjoy living there? Will my spouse enjoy living there and have a good life? One thing that I'd like to tell people is, if you're going to have more income than what you owe, refinancing and paying back your loans is at some point is pretty much a no-brainer. There's almost no chance that you're going to get forgiveness in any significant sense of the word. After I have seen the results of the 2020 election and considered what the student loan reform possibilities might be, my thought process is there's almost no chance that you will benefit from keeping your loans on the federal system long-term if you earn more than what you owe. There is probably not a benefit long-term to keeping your loans federal if your debt-to-income ratio is as high as 1.5 to 1. So for example, if you have $300,000 of student loan debt and you earn more than $200,000, it is unlikely, I think, that keeping your loans federal will result in any significant savings. I didn't say 100%. You could still have some savings if you keep your loans federal, perhaps. For example, if they eliminate the tax bomb or give you a bigger deduction, say 300% of the poverty line instead of 150%, right? But it could also go the other way. They could also reduce the size of the deduction for high-income earners, as Senator Elizabeth Warren has proposed in the past. Because if you think about it, our student loan system is essentially a flat tax. Right? As ironic as that is, it's not progressive at all. In fact, you can make an argument that the student loan IDR plans are actually somewhat regressive because someone who's very high earning, like an oral surgeon or orthodontist, pays 10% of their income, and a psychologist or social worker, somebody along like that, also pays about 10% of their income. And the only difference is you get a little bit of a deduction. But after that deduction, it's the same percentage of your pay, no matter how much you earn and how much your debt size is. And that's the exact opposite of what we do in the tax code. In the tax code, if you earn more than $400,000, every dollar you pay above that is taxed at 37%. It's only taxed at 12% if you're making $30,000, $40,000. So that's a massive difference in treatment. So I do think that there will be a realization at some point among progressives that the IDR plan benefits high-income earners. And so I think there'll be pushback on allowing ever more generous income-driven repayment plan terms to high-income borrowers long-term. Now, I don't think that, again, you will be pushed off of your plan. I think that most proposals I've ever seen have always talked about the importance of grandfathering people into whatever plan they're on if they like it, right? Certainly, Republican proposals have always suggested that. Democratic proposals have never suggested raising the rates people will have to pay for borrowers that are already in repayment. But I think that if you're talking about, will I have to pay my debt off, don't get distracted by the noise around student loan debt cancellation. That's not going to benefit you. If you have $10,000 of student loan cancellation across the nation, that's going to help out people that basically couldn't get a job or didn't get a job exactly like they wanted, that had maybe had to drop out of school for whatever reason, and they're working as a barista at Starbucks, right? That's kind of the folks that will truly help the most. Think about the person who wasn't able to complete their degree or got defrauded by a for-profit college and they haven't gotten their debt discharged yet. Maybe they're in default, perhaps. Maybe they work as a, let's say, just an office manager somewhere at a local small company. They make $40,000 a year. They have $20,000 of student loan debt. That's who student debt cancellation is going to be focused on helping, because the cost of canceling student loan debt, there was a really interesting piece, I think, in the New York Times a couple weeks ago that talked about how student debt cancellation would cost around $1 trillion, which is equivalent to all of the Pell Grants provided to all low-income students since the 1970s. And it's also equivalent to the amount of welfare that we've paid since the 1970s. So there's a little bit of a pushback on the left that's renewing around the discussion of student debt cancellation, where the goal is to limit that benefit to low-income borrowers. So as much as you're thinking, oh my gosh, they suspended my payments, they suspended my interest during this IDR plan period, I better really second guess paying my debt off. No, it's about the same as it is previously to this. It's about the same as it is previously. If you have a debt to income ratio that's better than 1.5 to 1, if your loans are federal, you probably should be thinking, okay, I better get ready to refinance when they start charging interest again, because these rates are near record lows. And then if your debt-to-income ratio is worse than that, then you probably would benefit from going for forgiveness. But keep in mind, as the premise of this show is about, you really do need to consider, where do I want to live and what kind of life do I want to have? So here's something to think about. If you go to an area where you're going to make a lot more, it's a lot more likely you're going to pay your loans off. And we know that for healthcare jobs, at least, if you go to a place that's out of the way, a little bit less desirable place to live, then your salary tends to be a lot higher and your profits tend to be a lot higher. So why is that? One reason is because the cost of providing those services is extremely low. Consider this. If you are in the middle of nowhere place, the rent for your building might be I don't know, $15 a square foot, let's say. If you live in a very expensive place to do business, it could be $100 a square foot. Labor costs are similar. If you have a great job as a front desk office assistant that, you know, is stable employment, it's predictable, it's secure, comes with healthcare and benefits, 401k match, you might be one of the few employers in a whole region that offers that, particularly for healthcare, a healthcare environment. So you might be able to pay $10 to $15 an hour where somebody in, say, Southern California is going to be competing with all of the wonderful jobs available in that region, and they might have to pay $25 to $30 for the same person. So your labor costs and your rental costs are always the biggest costs associated with providing healthcare services, in most places at least. So that means that your cost of doing business is so much lower that you don't have to make nearly as much revenue. You don't have to see nearly as many patients, do as many procedures, etc., to make the same amount of money. Now, that's on the cost side. What about on the revenue side? One podcast I like to listen to just for business wisdom is Dr. Howard Fran's Dentistry Uncensored podcast. So he likes to say, go where they ain't. So just as a personal example, I'll use dentists as an example just because I think it really kind of applies to a lot of healthcare professionals. There's three dental offices within three blocks of my house. Literally, I can walk 1 minute away and there's a dental office. I can walk 3 minutes and there's another dental office. And the one that I go to is about a 5 minute walk, I guess because it helps me stretch my legs before going to my appointments. I don't know. I think it's just because my wife got referred there by somebody at the hospital and the guy wasn't very pushy and pretty nice to talk to. So I was like, okay, I'll just go here. But I had, before I got married, before my wife and I got married, she had her healthcare at the hospital and I had my, I was not basically paying for a real healthcare plan for myself because it was just me. This is back in like 2016 or so. I had a health share ministry plan, right? So a lot of my friends like to deride me about this because it's not really health insurance. It's basically this thing that you are only eligible for if you belong to a particular faith community and the cost is very low and the deductible is quite low, but it's not necessarily guaranteed that they're going to cover everything. You can't have pre-existing conditions, for example. It's kind of like this loophole that allows people that don't have affordable health insurance to have something. So anyways, that aside, I had a random PPO plan, which is just a dental plan as part of this random quasi-legit health plan I was on. And I just asked my dental office, I said, do you take this PPO? It was one of the most random ones that I never even heard of this one before. And they had to look it up and they had a super long list of all the PPO insurance plans that they accepted. And they found it on the list and they're like, oh, yep, we actually take it. Why did they take it? Why did they accept it? It's because if they didn't accept it, then I could go down the street to two other competitors and literally ask both of them, hey, do you take this? So of course my dentist didn't have to take my insurance, but he didn't have a ton of options because of the level of competition that was in the area. And at least my place, my city is a little bit lower cost of doing business with lower cost of inputs for labor and rent than a lot of places. But in the competition side of things, it is pretty legit. There's quite a bit of competition available. So let's talk more about healthcare professionals more generally. Living in a big city gives lots of amenities like culture, shopping, dining, good airports that'll take you a lot of places, sporting events, just a lot more things that appeal to a lot of people, especially people with high incomes and high education. And also healthcare professionals tend to train in big cities. So if you're going to go to dental school or medical school or pharmacy school, etc., there's not a lot of those programs in the middle of nowhere with nothing but cornfields around you. Even when those places are in college towns, there's still a nice little vibrant downtown usually in these places, right? And more commonly, you'll see, for example, the medical school for a university might be in the main big city in the area, whereas the location for the college might be in the smaller college town. So I think that healthcare professionals get used to living in these big cities and enjoying the amenities as a young 20-something person. Therefore, I think proportionately, medical professions might not attract as many people as exist out there in America that like to ride four-wheelers, hunt, and shoot, and go deep water fishing. You know, I mean, so I think that a lot of those sort of rural hobbies and interests don't necessarily, they're not necessarily represented in medical professions as much as it exists in the United States. Because you have that self-selection bias, I think you get a strong demand for specific metro areas where a lot of these amenities that exist are at. So in Econ 101, supply determines the price. Demand is going to be kind of similar everywhere for things like healthcare services unless people are very low income and can't afford them. But even then, with Medicare, Medicaid, Affordable Care Act, the demand side is able to pay in a way that it maybe hasn't been in the past. So on the supply side, what is kind of determining the price and the incomes for people in bigger cities, these more desirable locations, is how many practitioners do you have per 1,000 people? So in other words, if you have very little competition, you can charge more for your services and you can accept fewer or even no insurance plans because people don't have a lot of flexibility to go elsewhere. Supply-demand. So one ratio that's relevant here, and forgive me for using dentists as an example again, but there's a population-to-dentist ratio that exists, and it's really fascinating because it shows you approximately how much competition that you might have to deal with in a given area. So the University of Iowa publishes this awesome map that shows the population-to-dentist ratio for every county in Iowa, and it shows also how many dentists in that county are over 60 years old. I think they do this because they're trying to attract new graduates to places in great need of dentists. But there's a county in Iowa called Franklin County. It's got 10,674 people, so over 10,000 people, and it has one dentist in the whole county. And that dentist happens to also be over 60 years old. There's also another county there, Palo Alto County, Iowa, that has 9,000 people and one dentist for the whole county. So there's plenty of counties in Iowa where there's almost 10,000 people to one dentist. Now in San Francisco, by comparison, the most recent report that I saw said the population to dentist ratio was 650 to 1. Okay, here's some more urban areas that I'll mention here. Falls Church, Virginia, that's in the DC suburbs. That ratio is 320 people to one dentist. In New York City, it's 560 to 1. What about in Florida? In Florida, this is a kind of one that might throw you for a loop. Alachua County is in first place at the worst population dentist ratio, 570 to 1. Why so high? Well, that happens to be where my alma mater, University of Florida, is located, and it has the oldest, I think, largest dental school in the state. And so people, when they go somewhere for a long time and enjoy the football and the basketball, and they kind of get used to an area, people are a lot more likely to sort of stay put. So my thought there is you just have a lot of people that enjoy living in that area that decide to just settle down and stay there. Next, most concentrated, of course, is in South Florida, near Nova Southeastern University's dental school. And then obviously just Broward, Palm Beach counties, Miami-Dade counties. It's just, again, where people want to congregate and rise, have tons of suppliers that push down the price of healthcare that you can charge. By the way, I've got all that data from this really interesting website, countyhealthrankings.org, if you wanted to check and see what the population to dentist ratio is for other places in the country. So think about that Northern Virginia example. I'll tell you one consult that I had once. This person told me they were working 5 days a week plus every other Saturday. So basically 5.5 days a week, and they were earning $110,000 a year. And I was floored because this person had been out of school for like a year or two. And of course, they were working for a dental service organization, and I was just, oh man, I was floored. I was shocked. I mean, because that's really low pay, and this person was working more than 5 days a week. And then I said, well, how many offices are near you? And they said, well, there's probably 5 or 6 dental offices just in the strip mall that I'm in Northern Virginia. So with a ratio of 320 to 1, and this is true for all healthcare professionals, right? So put this in the context of what you do. If there is a ratio in your community of 300 to 1 for your profession, and then in another county, there's a ratio of 10,000 to 1, there's 30 times as much competition in Northern Virginia as there is in rural Iowa. So the person in Northern Virginia has got to accept anything offered to them, has to work their tail off, has really high costs because of just the high cost of living area they're in, has to probably do so many more procedures than the person in Iowa does just to break even and pay their expense. Plus, they have to work almost 6 days a week just to survive and make a decent income. And then if you contrast that to the place that really needed that healthcare professional in the rural part of the country there, this person probably doesn't even have to know what Yelp is, aside from when you step in a dog's tail, the dog yelps, right? The person doesn't have to know what Facebook is. They don't have to have an SEO marketing plan. Their SEO marketing plan is put the name of their county on their website, and automatically they will show up number one for every search that someone does on Google in that area because they're the only choice. If anyone is in that county and wants to provide dental coverage, then negotiating with that one dentist, that's the only option. So if there's county employees, say, of a few hundred people and they want to provide dental insurance, they're going to use the one provider in the county and they're probably going to have to pay whatever the person wants versus just basically giving them a predetermined list and saying, here's our prices. Because guess what? If you don't accept that, then you've got to drive 2 hours to the nearest dentist. This is the same exact thing for any medical specialty, be it psychology, being a physician, a surgeon. Now, it's a little different perhaps for some situations like surgeons. You might argue, well, extremely specialized surgeons might cluster in health complexes in really large cities, and then all the patients will travel specifically because that surgeon's so skilled and that's they command a premium. It's not necessarily related to their supply. So it's not a perfect one-to-one, but it's pretty darn close. If you have a lot of pharmacists that live in a town where the demand for medication is probably not all that different, right? You're going to have CVS and Walgreens say, well, you know what? We don't need to pay full-time hours, so we're just going to offer everyone part-time and we're going to have 10 applications for one spot. One thing that's kind of interesting about the pharmacy profession is the pandemic has really sort of papered over to a lot of the problems in the profession that were sort of facing people before this pandemic was just the oversupply, just because there's all kinds of need right now for pharmacists to deliver vaccines, staff all these pharmacies that are just under siege for demand for people that are stuck at home. And so who knows what it'll be long term, right? But that's kind of what happens when you have an oversupply. It's not just oversupply across the country. You can say, well, there's an oversupply of fill in the blank profession, but that's just not true. There's an oversupply in downtown New York, but probably a huge undersupply in Buffalo. There's probably a massive oversupply in Los Angeles and a massive undersupply in the Central Valley. There's probably a massive oversupply in Salt Lake, but a massive undersupply in rural Utah. So if you go across the country, you can really use the supply-demand kind of thinking to think, how tough is life going to be from a financial perspective? Another thing that you have when you're a business owner in one of these places that's not at least super expensive, where you're competing with other really high wage paying businesses for things like commercial real estate rentals and employee competition, is you have leverage over your employees because they'd have to drive a long time to find another job too. So you don't have to worry about staff turnover and loyalty as much either. One thing that I've seen in my business with the clients that I've worked with, people that make over $600,000 a year tend to be either extremely specialized in the sense that they have a lot of different credentials and been in all kinds of programs, and there's not very many people that do what they do, or they're simply in locations where they're very much needed because there's a shortage. And it's not just about rural versus urban either. I've seen people making a ton of money in big cities in the Midwest. I've seen people make a ton of money, obviously, in rural places, but I've seen people make a lot of money, even in places that you might deem are a little oversaturated. But what tends to happen is when the people are in these big cities, like in LA or New York or something, if you're making a ton of money, it's because you are extremely specialized and people view you as the best, right? That's kind of how you make big money, I think, in these bigger locations, especially as a healthcare professional. If you are in a shortage area, you don't have to be the best. You just have to be competent. And there's going to be so much demand that it's going to work out pretty well. So obviously not everything is finances. I'm just simply talking about if you go to this place where you're needed, you're probably more likely to make a debt to income ratio low enough that it makes sense to pay back your loans. Whereas if you go to a place like a New York or LA or some sort of big city that you've always wanted to live in, that makes loan forgiveness a lot more likely of a strategy. Obviously, not everything is about finances. My wife loves her opportunity to practice academic medicine for a lot less money in big cities. She enjoys the culture. She enjoys the amenities. She enjoys the ability to research and teach fellows and residents. And that's good. That's good that she knows what she wants. Either path is okay if you want that, but you do need to plan for things like, what is your retirement date? What would you like that to be? What would you like your lifestyle to be? What would you like your options for your loans to be? Do you want to have no choice but to go for forgiveness, or do you want the option to pay it back or go for forgiveness? Those kind of locational decisions really influence that. Let's talk about housing for a second. In New York City, finances are totally different than what they are in a smaller town, right? There's this website, smartasset.com, that has a list of price-to-rent ratios by city. I think it's really fascinating because price-to-rent ratios, I like to think about it like price-to-earnings ratios in the stock market, where you have a high price divided by earnings ratio means the stock's kind of really sought after, really valuable, but also has more kind of risk, right? Because there's not as much earnings backing up the price. So it's kind of like that with housing, sort of. It's not a perfect analogy, obviously, but if you have a house that's $500,000, and the annual rent for that house would be $10,000, then you'd have a price to rent ratio of 50 to 1. And the price to rent ratio of 50 to 1 is actually what the ratio is in San Francisco. Another way to say that is that's basically like a 2% rental yield. So if you buy a $2 million house in San Francisco, that's saying you're approximately going to expect to make $40,000 a year in income off of that house. And that might be fine, except you got to pay property taxes, you got to pay maintenance costs, you have to pay for homeowners insurance, you have to pay for attorney fees and CPA fees for managing the income from that property, and you have to deal with paying your mortgage payment as well. And so you're almost guaranteed in that kind of a place to be very negative on the monthly payments for all of the ownership costs versus the renting costs. Why do people buy in a town like San Francisco? Like, say you're a doctor, you want a physician or something like that, you want to buy in San Francisco. Why do people do it? Well, housing values exploded in San Francisco because it's the capital of tech. There's been limited supply. And so when people get a giant $10 million payout from an IPO, what do? They go plop down whatever it costs to get a really nice house that's single family off to themselves that they can live in forever in San Francisco. But in a place that has a really high price to rent ratio, price divided by annual rent, that ratio is above 30, there's a lot of risk there. So for example, Elon Musk has left California for Texas. HP and Oracle announced they're moving their headquarters from California to Texas. There are new companies like Airbnb printing money with big IPOs in California. So who knows what happens with California real estate? Maybe the boom continues. But there's a situation where you really got to think about when you, if you want to buy a house in a big city, it might make you a lot more likely to be a loan forgiveness candidate than a refinancing candidate. Because again, if you want to buy a house, go ahead. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. It just might not be the best financial decision if your goal is retiring in a reasonable time and having not a lot of stress with how many hours you need to work. But if your goal is to live in a really nice house and own your own place, that's okay. Like, that's up to you, right? Here's an example of how the math works. If you have a $1.8 million house with a 3% 30-year mortgage, the payment's about $7,600 a month. The rent, according to this website on that place, might be maybe $3,500 a month, something like that. Keep in mind that mortgage payment does not include property taxes, maintenance, HOAs, etc. So where are some other bad places financially to buy a house compared to renting a house? Well, there's Honolulu with, and I'm just going to name the number after it as the price to rent ratio. So Honolulu is 40, LA is 39, New York is 36, DC is 34. Those are also places that tend to have low healthcare worker wages because there's an oversupply of people that want to live and work there. So the wages that you pay to healthcare workers are less because the supply is greater. So what are some good places to buy? So Louisville, Kentucky, Fort Worth, Indianapolis, Buffalo, those price to rent ratios are 10 to 16. And that's maybe not places you'd want to live. That's okay. There's no shame in that. But somebody that lives in a Louisville, Fort Worth, Indianapolis, Buffalo kind of a place is going to be more likely to pay off their loans than somebody that lives in a Honolulu, LA, New York, or DC kind of a place. And that's just because a lot more of your wages are going to be committed to housing costs and daycare costs and other big fixed expenses in these places where they're really expensive to live in. And that's going to leave you less money to pay back your loans. And since you'll be making lower wages probably in a place like the ones I mentioned in those sort of attractive urban cores, that's going to make it more likely that your debt to income ratio is going to be high, which is going to make you a bigger candidate for loan forgiveness. There's no shame in that at all. The key is that you want your loan plan optimized for what you want. You need to have your loans be designed for what your life goals are. Not mine, not your friend that you went to school with, not your uncles, not your parents. It's you and your life partner, spouse, whoever your significant other is, that is who needs to be happy with what you've decided to do with your student loans and your overall finances in general. Maybe you want the awesome shopping, big city vibe. That's worth a lot to you. You'd accept a lot lower pay for that. That's okay. Maybe you sit inside and just like to watch Netflix, don't really care for sporting events, don't really care about restaurants, and you like hobbies like camping and shooting shotguns and stuff like that. Well, so maybe go a place where you're not paying a premium to not take advantage of all those amenities that your rent is sort of implicitly charging you for. If you're in a high-cost area, you'll probably work until your 60s, and there's no problem with that. Also, like I said, you're a lot more likely to go for forgiveness because your income is going to be more capped because of the supply and the competition and the higher costs of doing business. And if you are in a less quote-unquote desirable place or more out-of-the-way place, Midwest, Southeast, you know, West outside of the coast, you're more likely to be debt-free sooner, more likely to retire in your late 40s, early 50s, might have more limited cultural amenities. One more thing that I didn't talk about, also community property states can really influence your loan strategy. There's 9 states in total. Most of them are in the West Coast. That's basically the West Coast, the Southwest, touching the Mexican border, and then Wisconsin. Those are the community property states for the most part. And then a couple random ones like Nevada and Idaho, I believe, as well. And Alaska, I think you can opt into community property. But if you have that situation, say you're in Kansas and you make $800,000 a year and you have $800,000 in debt, I would say refinance and pay it back. But if that same couple was working in Las Vegas or, you know, California or something with a community property state, or Arizona or Texas, right, you could file separately for taxes and split that income of $800,000 into 400 and 400. Let's say you have a spouse that doesn't make an income, and maybe that spouse helps out at the practice but doesn't really make a formal income. So now your pay-as-you-earn payment would be based on $400,000 of income instead of $800,000. Your debt-to-income ratio went from 1-to-1 to actually 2-to-1, and now you'll get a lot of potential forgiveness that can happen. Instead of having to pay it back, you can get a lot forgiven. So it really does depend on what kind of state you live in terms of tax policy, and it depends on where you want to live long-term for your own personal goals for your life, what kind of career you want, how many hours you want to work. That's another thing we didn't talk about. Some places are a little easier to work part-time. I mean, heck, if you live in a place that's got a really nice beach and you like to surf, maybe you want to work part-time. I had a really great case with a specialist healthcare professional, and her big thing was, I have 3 beautiful children and a spouse that doesn't make a taxable income because he's looking after the kids. And I'd like to spend more time with them, and I'd like to take them to the beach more. And I'd like to be able to take them on a Wednesday and not just on the weekends. And sure enough, I looked at her finances, and her expenses were fairly low. Her rent wasn't very high. She drove a paid off car, and she didn't have a desire to retire before 60. So in that case, because she chose a really sunny, beautiful place to live, her situation also called more for loan forgiveness, because she had a lot of opportunities to enjoy one of the beautiful nature and scenery and opportunities that she had living that place. Thank goodness for the blessed souls that are dentists in North Dakota or physicians in North Dakota, right? But I'm going to guess that between November and March in North Dakota, and I'm going to get maybe some hate emails from this, I don't know, but I'm going to guess that there's not a ton outside of winter kind of sports. There's not a ton to do except for work. I don't know. Maybe that's probably a really insensitive thing to say. I hope you still want to listen to our show after this if you're in one of those states. I thank you for your service, right? I'm joking around a little bit because I used to think in college, you know, one of the reasons that they put the Ivy Leagues in the Northeast is because it's so dark and cold in the winter. It's a lot more likely that you're going to want to study all the time. that's why they put finals when it's cold, right? The hardest finals or whatever, you want that to line up when you're stuck inside studying really hard. And then when it's really pretty out, you hope that you don't have to study as hard. I don't know. I mean, that's one thing that is tough, right? About your, why are party schools kind of in places like Arizona State or University of Florida? It's great weather. It's wonderful to be outside, so a little harder to study. I'm being honest. I'm joking around here, folks, but you get what I'm trying to say, that if you are in a place where you really want to take advantage of those amenities, and maybe you do live in one of those really cold states and you love to ski, right? And so maybe that location makes you more likely to go for loan forgiveness. And maybe if you're in a beachside place and you don't really care for the beach that much, maybe that makes you want to work more. But I think that one thing that we don't think about is that it really does depend on your location for what you want your loan strategy to be, because your location impacts housing costs, your salary, your opportunities, your income ceiling, the cost of doing business. It affects whether or not you're filing taxes separately or jointly for your loans. And it might not even impact other things like how much money you have. If there's no income tax, you have more money to save for investments and have more money to put away. And then also just, if you don't have to compete against as many people, you might be able to work fewer hours too and make the same amount of money. All kinds of things to think about for where you live and how that affects your income and your loan forgiveness strategy. So hope you enjoyed today's show. Remember, you can ask a question with a voicemail. Please have a wonderful holiday season. Again, if you're traveling, be safe. And if you're hunkering down, please just look forward to better times, right? I'm certainly excited about what 2021 might bring, because I think there's a pretty low chance it's going to be tougher than this year, I hope. So thank you for listening to our show. Obviously, if you need a student loan plan, feel free to book one of those, studentloanplanner.com/book. Take care.